Traditionally, this weekend around June the 21st is one of my favorite weekends of the year for four reasons. One is usually it's the weekend for the U.S. Open Golf Tournament, but not this year. The other is that June the 21st is the longest day of light in the year, and I love long days of light. It gives me more time to be outdoors and enjoy things. But also, more personally, June the 20th, yesterday, was Anita's and my anniversary, our 17th anniversary, and we celebrated it together, at least virtually by phone, as she continues, at least she is now back in Jacksonville, which, just to correct Susan's one mention, Anita will not be here next Sunday on the 28th, but I will. Hopefully she will rejoin the Birmingham clan sometime later in the summer. And the fourth reason is that yesterday is or was our grandson Finn's fifth birthday. Every year during this time, it seems full of fun and fellowship and especially family. Especially when you're a father and a grandfather. I mean, what's not to like about Father's Day? Unless you happen to read this morning's lectionary passage. There's a lot not to like on Father's Day here. As some people have been heard to say, it's a real buzzkill. Now, I've already shared that I like to preach from the common lectionary, and again, for the reason that it's common all over the world in churches and denominations, Catholic and Protestant, many of whom use this lectionary, it's so powerful to think that these words are being proclaimed from pulpits all over. But mostly I like the common lectionary because it holds me accountable to a text that is given to me that I don't necessarily pick out in order to justify a particular point I want to make, a proof text for however I'm feeling or what I want to proclaim at that particular time. It is the subject, not me. But I gotta tell you, today, I wish there was no such thing as a lectionary text. Jesus is prone to throw us a curveball, as he did those disciples through these words. And today is not only a curveball, it is such a curveball that it hits us right upside the head with it. Hear now the words from Jesus in Matthew's gospel in the 10th chapter, verses 34 through 39. Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. Prince of Peace, peace and goodwill toward all men, women. Do not think I have come to bring peace on earth. I have come to bring not peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and one's foes, enemies, will be members of one's own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Those who find their life will lose it. And those who lose their life for my sake will find it. This is the word of the Lord. I don't know about you, but I'm finding it harder and harder to communicate these days, not only because of all of the political and racial and COVID things that act as barriers and boundaries to communicate with each other, but I'm talking about just basic, simple communication. Especially when you're wearing a mask and you're 6 feet apart. The other day, I dropped my clothes off at Suds and Duds to have them washed and folded and cleaned. And I, as I was paying the bill, I noticed a woman sitting off by the side eating this incredibly ripe peach. And so I looked at it and I said, wow. I've been looking for peaches since I got to Birmingham and I can't find them. I did buy some at Winn-Dixie, but there were these like hard little round things. She nods. I said, where did you get it? You want peaches? Right next door, Papa John's. I went, what? They have peaches? Yeah, next door, Papa John's. Now, I'm not always the brightest bulb in the chandelier, so I walked out of Suds and Duds right next door to Papa John's and walked in and looked around. Maybe they had a stand of peaches set up, unusually for Papa John's, and I asked the woman behind the desk, do you sell peaches here? She goes, yeah, right up there above you. It's in the menu. No, peaches. Then I got it. She thought I was saying pizzas. I'm not really aware of the Alabama dialect yet to be able to know how to have these conversations so much, but hopefully after a while I'll get it. Jesus, knowing how hard it is to communicate no matter the circumstances, often goes out of his way to hit us in the head with a word that is so vital and so ultimate and important that we cannot miss it. He does so with parables, with hyperbole, with any available way possible other than truth, distruth, lies, or coercion. And in this morning's text, he stands up there and says, in case in point, I have come to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother. And in Luke's passage, if you read it, it's even stronger. He says in Luke's passage, if you do not hate your father or your mother, you are not worthy to follow me. And golly, if I'd only just picked the fifth commandment, honor thy father and thy mother. Honor them. For if you do, all your days will be long. Who doesn't like that? Well, actually, the children in those days probably didn't like it, because what it means to say all your days will be long is to say if you honor your father and your mother and do not strike or curse them, you will survive. If, in fact, you strike or curse them, according to the law, it is punishable by death. So honoring them was how you lived. Those are old world family values. When Jesus says these hard words about separating from our families, it might help us to know that those family values in those days were hard and less about emotional needs being met and more about economic needs being met. As farmers and shepherds, as fishermen and merchants, the whole family unit was needed to sustain their life's worth, their ability to live, to have food. All the family from all the generations would work together, needed in order to survive. And it was basically a first world culture. Think of the weight this put on the family unit and why the story of the prodigal son is even more moving. That the son leaves home with the inheritance, which undermines the whole basic economic system for the family, and yet the father still embraces him on his way home. In the best circumstances, today a family provides roof over your head, 3 square meals a day, a safe and healthy emotional attachment, love and affection, stability and safety, spiritual and social values, teaching and training about relationships, responsibilities, and growing up, and a host of other basic needs in the best of circumstances, and no family lives in the best of circumstances. Families that do their best are able to provide some of this, but not all. And especially families who are struggling with so much in a world that requires so much to survive. The data, I don't know what it is in Birmingham, the data show that the majority of children in our world grow up in hardship, fear, abuse, hunger, and abandonment. So many, it will break your heart. For too many children and adults, Father's Day or Mother's Day is not a great day to celebrate. And it just brings sadness for a host of reasons. And maybe this is why Jesus said what he did about let the little children come unto me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. Not because, like today, little children are so cute and adorable and we love those little children's sermons, because at least we can understand those, if not the long one the preacher preaches, but because children were basically powerless. They were meant to work and not be heard, and over half never lived to puberty. I think maybe Jesus knew if he could just hold them in his hands, he would give them a sense of the amazing power and love and unconditionality of God, at least for a moment. Yes, Jesus acts like a sword dividing sons and fathers, daughters and mothers. Yes, Jesus comes along, disrupts the traditional systems that we live in. Yes, the patriarchal system back then and even still, the practice of primogeniture, the oldest son inherits everything, the role of priestly power in the temple. Yes, Jesus comes along and disrupts our allegiance to whatever political party that we sign on to or any other idolatry that we depend on to be our source of identity and salvation. Yes, he comes with a sword and by grace cuts us away from it. This is true in Mountain Brook, in this area of Birmingham, as well as any place on earth with our own affluent tangles and dysfunctions. Those dysfunctions, if you live in it, you understand, are about, I don't know, a sense of entitlement and works righteousness, and the pressure to perform and measure up to some really high standard. There's this incredible expectation of the family system that everything will be practically perfect in every way, which leaves families caving in from the pressure of having to raise their kids and the kids' pressure of having to live up to going to some huge Ivy League college when they graduate so that they can maintain their status or at least be popular, even if it means they are willing to become mean and forego the basic family values like honesty and kindness and generosity and gratitude and care for those who aren't just like us. We have our own entanglements. When Jesus said he came to bring not peace but a sword, he meant that he was going to cut us away from it. That all who hunger and thirst for righteousness now are free to come unto me. And that all, even in the very best families, the love and nurture that we provide is just a small approximation of the incredible and ultimate love that God provides, that we come to know through Jesus Christ. And that love and that unconditional affection for us, Jesus says, is what makes us whole and gives us the strength to pick up our cross and follow. A word of warning here. Cult leaders understand this. They always promise a better family than you have now, requiring you to disown your family, never talk to them again, and become completely dependent on the cult leader. But that's just a deeper dysfunction of dependence. What Christianity offers in Jesus Christ is exactly the opposite. Instead of dependence, it's inner dependence. If baptism tells us anything, it is this, that water is thicker than blood. That in this baptism, a child is confirmed, if a child or an adult, and lifted up to God as a child of God. Our role, the whole church's role, our community is to support and nurture this one, this child, in this extended family of God, way bigger than the nuclear family that we grow up in, to give this child this godness, all the godness that we can give him or she, he or she, and with every chance to grow up into their full selves as they were created in God's image. Baptism clearly states that this journey starts with our dying unto ourselves, going down into the waters and coming back up, raised again into a new life with a brand new family system that's bigger than the one we grew up in. Community of brothers and sisters. Black and white and red and yellow and green if there are Martians around. It doesn't matter. All of us, children of God, even the child who's screaming her guts out because the creature preacher is holding her up and putting water on her head and all she wants is her mother. Even each one of us who are screaming our guts out because all we want is someone to care for us. I have this theory, I don't know, it's not just my theory, but it's the cultural influence on families that break us down because way too much is expected. Since fewer and fewer families are involved in church communities these days, they're left having to provide not only all of the basic needs, but in Maslow's needs hierarchy, the highest level of need of spiritual enlightenment, of nurturing in love. And families just can't really hold up to that. And I know it sounds old-fashioned, and call me old-fashioned, but the data shows that there is a correlation between regular religious attendance and one's health and wellness. In fact, it's such a correlation that it is as good for our wellness as smoking is bad for our wellness. And you can ask why, and there are lots of theories, but one theory is that we need each other, that we are not truly ourselves unless we're in relationships with others and greater than our own families. We need each other in this dadgum COVID world that we live in, which is why you see people going to bars now all over the place. Just not really a healthy lifestyle, because basically they're in need of people. When I watched those demonstrators the past weeks, mostly all young, racially diverse, it struck me how two things are true, both of them Jesus offers us. The first is a cause greater than we are, based in a community greater than we are, something bigger than just our own stuff. And Jesus offers us a cross to pick up that demands something of us that matters. Both community and cross. And the cross that we are called to pick up and carry, you see, is a deep passion for justice, for black lives, and for all lives that matter. From a system that is often too unjust. And we've all seen those bumper stickers that say, no justice, no peace. And I think that's partially true, but unless it is based on love and compassion, unless it is based on love and compassion, it morphs too easily into another realm of Pharisaic righteousness, ending up being like the French Revolution all over again. Ultimately, I believe that only love and compassion can bring us to a true sense of justice. Jesus is making this point. Relative to God's love, everything else is just an approximation, even justice. So it's a plea for the church. I'm throwing it out. It's a plea for the church. Everything else is part of it. The most valuable gift we have is a community of faith through Jesus Christ that we are called to give witness to. And not just the church, but Christ himself. Witness to our families and our friends and our world that so desperately stands in need of a word of love, compassion, and acceptance. That we are called to give witness to this amazing grace, affirming that we are loved and accepted by God no matter what, and that we are forgiven even when we've done what we think is unforgivable, and that we are empowered by this love and presence of God to pick up our cross and take care of it by having it shared with the world. That's purpose. And the powerful thing is that we give ourselves over to this. If we do, if we accept this and give ourselves over to it, we will lose our tiny little ego lives and discover something way much bigger than that. This is the first thing we do as a church, is to give witness to this love in Jesus Christ. You know, I can end there, but you know me well enough by now to know I want. There's something else I want to say, and it's a little more personal. It's Father's Day, and so I'm going to take my leave with it and say the cross that Jesus wants us to pick up, you see, is not his cross. He carried it for the whole world. He doesn't need us to carry it for him. It's not anybody else's cross. It's our cross. What I think that means, at least for me, is that I'm called to carry that place where I'm wounded, where I've been wounded, the hurt and the shame, where I've been invaded or where I'm trying to hide or where I'm trying to cover myself up like Adam and Eve, or that tapestry of experiences that we've all experienced somewhere in life where we didn't feel like we measured up, weren't good enough. We had this deep wound of being found out, which felt like my being wasn't good, and I no other word than shame. And what we hunger and thirst most for is to be loved right there in our deepest selves, and to be given assurance that we do, in fact, measure up. Think back through your life. The older you get, the easier it is. You got more to think back through. A while back, I was invited and prompted for a week-long course called High Impact Leadership Seminar, put on by a church member and owner of a business, a leadership business called Stop at Nothing. The first night, a PhD woman from UVA, a PhD in psychology, and also a deeply faithful Christian, I found out, began to tell us the story of how she was terribly abused as a child growing up by her grandfather that her mother knew about, but never intervened. So she grew up with the deceit of that as well as the incredible abuse. And as she shared her story, we were just completely broken for her. Then the next day she gets up and says, okay, now I want you to do it. Think back to when you were 4 or 5 years old and and think about some place in your life when you were wounded and where you experienced that kind of hurt. I could only count four when I was five or six. And they all, ironically, happened in Birmingham. I will mention three. I remember standing in the living room of our house on Wooddale Road on Valentine's Day at night when my younger brother was being born as my parents were in the hospital and it was snowing outside. And I'm standing beside my older brother, Jim, and he has such a terrible earache that all he can do is cry and wail for mom and dad to come home while our babysitter, who didn't seem to care too much, was watching television. And I was there at 5 years old feeling like I needed to do something, but I didn't know what to do. I didn't have anything to do it with. And I felt in some way responsible. And as I thought back over that experience, it occurred to me, you know what? Somehow God used that woundedness in me. I think maybe that had something to do with why I went into ministry. The second one, I think, was the summer after that. I was on a baseball team playing in a league, not Little League, but younger than that. In Avondale Park, we were the Pels. Never did find out what Pels meant, and I had a baseball uniform just like the pros. It was gray wool, and I had a hat, blue hat with a little orange. I've got a picture of myself in my office to remind me of this. And I hated baseball because I was scared to death of the ball. I would close my eyes when it was thrown to me or when I would swing, and I was so bad that I never played except one game. And it was momentous. I didn't tell you that before that, my parents let me ride my bike down to the park, which is about a half a mile away, which was unheard of these days. And as my older brother, Jim, was pitching in the Little League and my parents were watching him, I was playing with a duck in the lake pond and fell in and was completely submerged and stepped out, completely embarrassed with my game coming up in 45 minutes. So I got on my bike and pedaled back home and had enough sense to put them in a dryer and dry them out enough that I could hold my head up and go back into the game. But I didn't get into the game until we were either losing by so much or winning by so much that it didn't matter. And he put me in right field, which is where all the bad baseball players go. And I'm standing out there in my woolen pants, and under the lights, I see my mom and dad and my brother Jim, who I idolized, and knowing that I was inadequate out there, and I turned my pants dark, just like when I fell in the water under the lights. I remember that as if it were yesterday. Now, by God's grace and hopefully by God's redemption, I'm able to stand up here and preach under the lights, but it's also why I like to wear robes. And the third is, it's not important. Relatively, it's nothing. But in first grade, first day of school, my mother drops Jim and me off at Avondale School, just right around the corner, and I don't know what to do. I'm nervous and scared, and Jim drops me off at my classroom outside, and we're sort of hovering around waiting to go in, and some guy walks up who's bigger than I am, and he's obviously some bully, but I didn't know that, and he says, "What's your name?" And I said, "Steve." He said, "Come here, I want to show you something," and he walks over to the fire alarm that's on the telephone pole, and he reaches up to pull it down, and as soon as he did, a teacher comes up and grabs us both and whisks us in to the principal's office when I had to pull my pants down and be spanked by a ruler, which caused me to cry. I'm only like 6 years old, right? So then I have to go back into class, the whole class sitting there watching me walk into their class, first day of school, having not really met any of them, with tears going down my cheeks. And I thought maybe because of that, I just wasn't going to be a good student. That academics was not going to be my gift. So I learned to be with people, but I had never studied until I had to in college. I had to in college to graduate. And then I discovered that, you know what, maybe I went through that experience for some reason to understand what other kids who may have ADD or some other dysfunction or disability or handicap might be dealing with in their own life. Maybe I went through that to have some empathy, which is the whole point. These wounds that we have growing up are wounds to open us up to compassion and for empathy toward others. And our wounds are mostly very small relative to the woundedness of so many people in our world. Think of those people who are the wrong color and who grow up thinking because of that they do not count or not as good enough. Not even because they've done anything except be born. That's woundedness. And inasmuch as we can claim our own woundedness, can we claim some compassion and empathy with those who also share a woundedness in life? And that, you see, is the God part. For that is exactly what God shared with us in Jesus Christ. Woundedness on the cross. And inasmuch as we share that with each other, we are God-like with each other. This is our gift, our wounds. May God give us the strength to be generous with them. In Christ's name, amen.